Among the several lines that in President Barack Obama's inaugural address that perked up my ears was the one where he said, "We are a nation of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, and non-believers." Like much of what our new president puts out for public consumption, the words were carefully chosen, I'm sure, and also well chosen, I would say. I didn't research the matter, but I feel safe in saying that it was probably the first time an incoming president acknowledged in an inaugural address that not all Americans fit into the religious categories by which most of our citizens identify themselves. His message that these non-believers are as good and faithful Americans as all the rest is one I am very grateful to him for pointing out. And it's my gratitude that makes me feel a little hesitant to go nitpicking at a line that I actually liked. But that's never stopped me before, so nitpick I will, and not, I hope, for the sake of semantic game playing, but rather to get me launched into this sermon. I wish there were a term available other than one like non-believer to identify those people whose religious explorations and spiritual searches do not fit into the more traditionally religious categories. Talking of people like me, and many of you, I dare say as well. I am not an adherent of any of the faith traditions in any doctrinal or dogmatic way to which President Obama spoke, but neither do I consider myself a non-believer. I happen to believe in a lot of things of a religious and spiritual nature. I guess I wouldn't be in this, well, business, as it were, if I didn't. And as I thought on all this, I got the idea, listening to Gil and Kathy as well, I got the idea that maybe we should call ourselves the Church of the Non-Believing Believers. Well, I didn't really say it was a good idea. I just said it was an idea. And I could go with that if the name, I could go with such a name if the emphasis were kept on the word believers. For it is true, we offer an escape route here from dogmatism or from rote, secondhand, handed down beliefs. And that's all well and good and greatly needed. But this kind of escape route really leads to a dead end if it fails to also lead to a renewal of belief. A belief that involves embracing some core affirmations about life and living and claiming a spiritual path or a journey of meaning that is truly one's own. And this renewal often involves claiming a language that speaks to that path or journey, gives you a way of talking about where you're going in your explorations. And this reclaiming of language was really one of the first shots across the bow that the president of our Unitarian Universalist Association, Reverend William Sinkford, got off as his presidency began nearly 8 years ago. Those of you who are here know we were very privileged to welcome Bill Sinkford to this pulpit last Sunday. And when I introduced him, I noted that he has done an outstanding job of bringing our Unitarian Universalist principles and values to bear in the larger public arena on any number of issues of social justice. But Reverend Sinkford began his presidency, as I say, one of the first shots across the bow he got off as he began his presidency back in 2001, was an in-house challenge to our Unitarian Universalist family, calling upon us to embrace what he called a language of reverence. Well, that challenge alone was enough to set off a few alarm bells among some of our more devout humanists. It was an alarm that rang out, "Oh my God, he said God." Actually, he didn't. What Bill was, he actually drew a distinction between God language and what he was and still does call a language of reverence, and I will pick up on that point a little bit later. In more recent years, this same theme was picked up by yet another Unitarian Universalist minister named Bill, in this case, the Reverend William Murray, in a book that's just recently come out, published by our Skinner House Press, called Reason and Reverence. It was the title of Reverend Murray's book, but also gave me the title for my sermon today. Mr. Murray is a former president of our Unitarian Universalist Theological School in Chicago, the Medieval Lombard Theological Seminary. When I was the minister in residence there 5 years ago, he was moving towards retirement by having relinquished the school's presidency and was teaching a couple of classes on ministry, which he very graciously invited me to co-lead and co-teach with him for the term that I was on campus there. Before entering academia, Bill was for 17 years the minister of the River Road Unitarian Universalist Church in Bethesda, Maryland, which is one of our larger UU congregations. The subtitle of his book is Religious Humanism for the 21st Century. It's a good read, but it has an academic flavor to it, an academic flavor very well done. It doesn't translate that well into sermon material, so I'm only going to touch very lightly on its contents here. Recommend it to you if you'd like to peruse it yourself. Well, what both of our Reverend Bills are doing, attempting to do, both Sinkford and Murray, they're attempting to move their fellow Unitarian Universalists beyond a theist-humanist debate that has been playing out in Unitarian and Universalist and then UU circles at least since the drafting of the first Humanist Manifesto in the 1930s, to which a number of Unitarian and Universalist ministers signed on. And we got a playful rendition of that debate in the song that Gil and Kathy did for us a few minutes ago. That's very good, guys. We'll probably be calling on you again at some point to give us another run of that. Like a lot of debates, this is a healthy one. Healthy up to a point, that is. Very healthy in that it does indicate the range of thought and belief that are contained and celebrated within today's Unitarian Universalism. But it's the kind of debate that should not, in my opinion anyway, end up with a line being drawn in the sand between contending parties. And that has actually happened in the past in our movement in ways that in places have caused a certain amount of pain and friction and discord in some of our congregations. Over the past 20 years, which are the years that have corresponded to the time of my ministry here, I would say that we, and I'm speaking in very general terms now, just about not just here, but we in our association, I think we've managed to wash over that line in the sand in ways that I believe are good and productive while people still retain their various identities as theist, humanist, whatever other label they call for themselves. And I think that is largely because we are finding ways of integrating our emphasis upon the use of reason and rationality when it comes to matters of belief, with a rediscovered sense of reverence and even humility for the world and the universe in which we live and move and have our being. I'd like to speak in some of those ways, speak to some of those paths. I know for some of you I am plowing old ground, but we have new folk continually discovering Unitarian Universalism both here and other congregations, so old ground for some is freshly plowed ground for others, which is why I do a sermon like this from time to time. While the seeds of humanism in our liberal religious movement, they go back at least to the 19th century transcendentalists, to Emerson and Thoreau and the Alcotts and all those other folks who were hanging out with each other before the Civil War down around Concord, Massachusetts. It really wasn't, though, until the drafting of the Humanist Manifesto in the 1930s that humanism began creating a stir within the ranks of religious liberals. Now, I know if I were to offer up an item-by-item rendition of that manifesto, both the one in 1930 and the subsequently updated versions of that, if I were to start going through that thing piece by piece, I'd be looking at a lot of glazed eyes pretty quickly, and you guys would be checking your watches to figure when we're going to get out of here, so I'm going to let that go. What the humanist stance, though, boiled down to was and is an assertion that the natural world and universe, both what we know of it and what we don't know, do not yet know, is the only reality that we have. There is no realm of the supernatural, much less a supernatural supreme being who dwells in that realm. Humanism was and is also a positive assertion of the human capacity, our human capacity, for reason, creativity, meaning-making, our capacity for guiding our own human destinies without any kind of a supernatural divine will or guidance. And what really was when I came to this position myself, with a few tweaks here and there, that But I decided I was a humanist, and I took it from there. Taking it from there was what eventually got me here. But I've learned some things since then. I've learned that humanism, for me anyway, is really a beginning point rather than an end point when it comes to the liberal way in matters of religion and spirituality. I found that humanism begs as many questions as it answers. If the natural world and universe is all we have indeed, then what is our relationship to it? How are we connected to it? How do we, rightly fit in to the web of life that is continually at work within the realm of the natural? And I'd say it has been the environmental movement, the things that have happened since the Humanist Manifesto was drafted. It's been the environmental movement, the ecological movement, and the feminist theology movement that have primarily raised these kinds of questions and offered this kind of critique of classical humanism. The critique and the questions it raises go even further. If there is no separate realm of the holy or the sacred out there somewhere, might not we human beings still be able to find something of the sacred and the holy and the divine, if you will, within ourselves and within this natural world in which we live? That was the theme of the first song the choir sang for us, about our heart being in a holy place. And what kind of language can we use to speak about our relationship to the cosmos and to speak of the sacred and the holy that we find in the ordinary and even in the mundane? As I say, these are the kinds of questions that humanism begs as much as it answers. They're also the kinds of questions that Reverend Murray takes up in his book, where he looks at how those persons of humanist persuasion can move from reason to reverence, or move back and forth between reason and reverence without sacrificing or giving up either one. Now, the position that Reverend Murray comes to as he makes this case and writes his book is one that he calls humanistic religious naturalism. Now, that's a stance that resonates pretty well with me, but it doesn't exactly roll off the tongue. I tried to imagine the reaction if, in his inaugural address, our president had said, "We are a nation of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, and humanistic religious naturalists." You'd probably had 2 million people out there on the mall going, "What?" Rick Warren rolling off his chair. It would not have worked. I guess that's why the president decided to stick with non-believers rather than attempt to mention all the various beliefs that alleged non-believers have. But anyway, picking up on a theme I put out earlier, I like to think of our community here as a place where non-believers can learn to believe again in some new and different ways. And on this note, let me very briefly offer how my own way of moving between reason and reverence has come about. I offer it in the hope that some of it may connect with you. I found that I don't need, really, an alternate set of beliefs clearly laid out for me in the way the beliefs in which I was originally raised were. I find, instead, that I'm seeking for, and at times finding, a lens or a perspective through which to view and relate to the world around me. I'm looking for a lens, more than I'm looking for a delineated set of beliefs. And I take my cues here from the artists, and the poets, and the novelists. Someone like the wonderful John Updike, who just passed away this past week. Among the tributes given to him following his death was one that said, "His gifts were his eye and his sensibility, which enabled him to describe with an exactitude bordering on love how the world looked and what it felt like to make your way in it." I am neither an artist, nor a poet, nor a novelist myself, but I try to cultivate for myself what I would call an artistic consciousness. We're going to have a service next Sunday that's dedicated to that, and I hope you can come and attend it. For I, too, wish to see the world with love, as I make my way in it, even if I can't describe it in the ways that Mr. Updike did. I wish to see the world with love as I make my way in it. And there's something religious about that, God or no God. It is the poet or the artist who can see the sacred and the holy in the ordinary and the everyday, and they lift that up for us. And this, as noted, is not a belief so much as it is a way of looking at the world and letting the world speak to you on some deep and spiritual level. I seek experiences that let me know, in a way that transcends reason and rationality, that I am part of and have a deep connection to all of existence. Our interdependence with the whole web of life is an increasingly demonstrable scientific fact. But I need to feel that relationship as well as acknowledge it. For it is when I feel this relationship that I know that I am not alone in this world and universe, and that for all of my individualism, I am not an atomistic, detached being. I believe this was what Ralph Waldo Emerson was getting at when he wrote, "I am part and parcel with God." He was not talking about a relationship with the Supreme Being, but a relationship with all of life, a life that surrounded and engulfed it. For me, it is out of this very sense of relationship that I find my motivation for social justice work. If I'm connected to everything else, I have something to say about how that all works. It is out of this sense of relationship that I find my motivation for social justice work and for my desire to move even a few micro degrees that moral arc of the universe, which our Unitarian forebear, the Reverend Theodore Parker, maintained, bends towards justice. And finally, I look for connections that will sustain me in ways that go beyond my capacity for reason. And here I defer to my late colleague in the Unitarian Universalist Ministry, the Reverend Dean Starr, who passed away about 10 years ago. Dean was our district executive here in New Hampshire and Vermont when I first began my ministry with this congregation. Like me, he was raised in a near fundamentalist setting and found his way in time to his own brand of religious humanism. In 1992, Dean lost his adult son, Paul Starr, to the AIDS virus. As you can imagine, the loss was devastating to him, as the loss of a son or a daughter to any parent surely is. And Dean, when he got to the place where he could talk about it, he spoke of this most painful of experiences and how he came to terms with it. He spoke of it at a minister's gathering prior to our Unitarian Universalist General Assembly back in 1994. To this day, it remains for me one of the most moving personal stories I have heard. Dean said that after he lost his son, he gave up on ever finding any kind of joy in living again. But the best he was hoping for was just some kind of a release from the pain of his loss. He went on to tell, in this address, how he found himself in Naples, Florida, about a year after his son Paul had died. And while he was there, he even tried going to a church service, like the church in which he had first been raised, to see if he might find some kind of sustenance or healing there by going back to the religion of his youth, of his origin. And he said he came away from that service feeling as empty as when he had gone in. An evening or two later, he took a boat cruise off the west coast of Naples, and this is how he described the experience. The entire sky, from horizon to horizon, was aglow with color. Reds and purples and pinks and golds. Then the colors faded, and that indescribable deep, deep indigo of late twilight filled the sky. The boat turned around and headed back. There on the eastern horizon was a full and glorious moon. With tears streaming down my face, I realized that even though my son's being was scattered, he remained a part of this awesome beauty. We can never contain the beauty in which we live and move and have our beings. And whether we live or whether we die, we are contained in this beauty. Try that last line one more time. We can never contain the beauty in which we live and move and have our beings. And whether we live or whether we die, we are contained within this beauty. The belief contained in Dean's story and its conclusion is this. There is an uncontained beauty, a greater web of life, a larger chain of being. Some choose to call that the presence of God, that holds our temporal lives here and holds the continuing presence or effect our lives have beyond our earthbound existence. Catching a glimpse of that beauty did not remove the reality of the death of Reverend Starr's son. That remained with him for the rest of his life. But it did remind and reassure him that life with a capital L, is bigger than any one of us, and that its beauty ultimately transcends even the greatest of human tragedies, and that we are indeed a part of something greater than ourselves, by whatever language of reverence we may choose to speak of it. To live with this kind of awareness and this kind of conviction is hardly to live a life of non-belief. Rather, it is to be a believer in a very profound way. Dean also passed away 4 years after that 94 General Assembly. His spirit, too, is now contained in the beauty in which we all live and move and have our beings. And I hope blesses us here today. So, reason and reverence. However much of a believer or a non-believer we may need to be in order to meaningfully live, we also need a community like this one, where reason and reverence are both affirmed and celebrated. This is the community that we continue to build together, as I assume we are all in it together as well. Let's sing that together, our closing hymn, number 331, Life is the Greatest Gift of All.